two times you talked about momentum states and also reflection symmetry. So the last thing I did yesterday was to show that if we construct this kind of state, which is clearly a momentum state because we just, instead of just using a single representative as in the first momentum states we discussed, we just construct it based on that state, but one can easily verify that it's still a momentum state, no matter what is here. Now, P is the reflection operator, so the question was whether the state where this number P is plus minus 1, is it a state with parity P? And by explicitly acting with that P operator, we could see that actually we get back the number P times the state, but only in these special cases where K is 0 or K is pi, because that's where e to the I K R with plus or minus K would be the same. So the sign is different here and here. So for those special momenta, what that means is that for those special momenta, parity operator and the translational operator actually commute with each other in that subspace of the Hilbert space. So that means that or those two momentum blocks actually split into two smaller blocks with definite parity. Now, the question is now, can we also use this parity operator in some way for other momenta? And in a while we will see that that's the case. So first let us discuss what I call semi-momentum states. So semi-momentum states are basically just linear combinations of K and minus K states. So they will not be then momentum states because they mix two different momenta. But we will see that this is still very useful. So of course the reason you can normally do that is because K and minus K states are degenerate anyway, right? Like exactly as in single particle quantum mechanics, a free particle, the energy is not depending on the sign of the momentum, just a K square in that case. So in this case also, those states are degenerate, and that's why you can construct some linear combinations, any linear combinations of those basically. Okay, so just some notation, and now today I will actually go rather fast, so the slides will have a lot of details, and that's just so that you can go back if you need the details to look at it, but it would be very boring to go through all the algebra in detail, so I will point out the main things. So now just to add or subtract momentum states where we have the exponential, you can imagine it's then what we get is sines and cosines instead of the exponential. So if we add, we get cosine, and subtract, we get sine. And then I just use a common notation for that. So I introduce this label sigma, which refers to sine or cosine. So it corresponds to adding or subtracting the momentum state. And then we have this basically it's well-known trigonometric relations that will be used at some point. But again, I will skip the details. But if you are interested in checking whether I'm really right, you can go back and do it. So this is then the form of a semi-momentum state. So instead of in the momentum state where we have the exponential, we have this sine or cosine. And now we just need to consider K in this range, so this M here going from 1 to n over 2 minus 1, because the other half would again be the same state. So instead we have this sigma label. And now I will not here consider k equals 0 or pi, because those, anyway, we discussed before, and they split into these parity blocks. So now we'll consider general momenta here. So, I mean, one advantage of this immediately is that these states are real. Right? The momentum states are complex, but here I make real states. For 0 and pi, those original momentum states are already real. And we could not even define these sign states. So it's just sigma equals plus. So those fall into the same category, but only sigma plus one in that case. All right, so one can easily check that these states for different sigma are orthogonal to each other. All right. Now we need to consider the normalization of these states. And it's easy to calculate again. I don't give the details. And we can also, of course, compute the Hamiltonian matrix elements. And OK, you get something which looks similar to what we did with momentum states before. But now there can be a sign here. So these sigmas and taus in the Brand-Ket state here, the sign of the matrix element depends on those. So it's important to know that this sigma itself is not a conserved quantum number. It's just something we use to label states, but it's not like there's one block of sigma plus states and one block of sigma one states. So actually this now seems bad, because what that means is that these blocks are twice as large as the momentum blocks, right? Because for each k, we have both sigma plus one and sigma minus one, and this is not a conserved quantum number, so we basically have twice as many states in the block. So that may seem that this should actually be bad to use this. Okay, we went to from complex states to real states, but is that really worth the effort? Because now the matrices are twice as large. So why are they useful? Well, because actually it's real valued basis, but actually we can use parity in that basis. So those states are actually, we can make them eigenstates of parity. So if we just modify a little bit exactly as we did with the momentum states, where we tried this parity idea, we will now do it again. And now these are actually states with definite parity. So again, if you think about it, you can understand why. Because a momentum state except k equals 0 and pi does not have parity. If you reflect it, it goes in the other way, so it's clearly not. But the semi-momentum states already mix positive and negative momentum. So when you reflect it, you can imagine then that you can have symmetric and anti-symmetric states with respect to reflecting. So that means we can use now parity to split up these semi-momentum blocks in k minus 1 and k plus 1 blocks, where these plus and minus ones refer to the p here. But still within those blocks, we have both positive and negative sigma states. So now it's a little bit messier here. So these states are real, and the blocks are now, when we have used parity, are of the same state as the complex momentum blocks. So that can be an advantage. So now when we work in this basis, before when we constructed the Hamiltonian and constructed the basis, we had to check translations of a state. So a representative represented all the translated states that you could reach from a given state, and that given state is what we called the representative. Now, since we are dealing with reflection as well, the representative will represent all translations and all reflections and translations. So, for example, here, if we start with this state, this is now a representative. These are all translations of that state in the bit representation, so you can see that this is the smallest among all those integers. And this is the what we get if we first reflect and then translate. So now you can see that there is no translations of this state which brings us back to the same state. So the periodicity is 8 here, so this is for an 8-sat system. But if we reflect and translate, then we can get back to the same state. And now this is again something we have to keep track of when we construct the normalization and the Hamiltonian, because the normalization will depend on how many copies of the states we have, and you can see here that all of these states appear twice in this table. Yeah, please.
Is that general, or is that something that can occur?
Well, this can occur, for it depends on the state, so it doesn't have to occur. There are states where it does not occur. There are states where you would have four copies of each of them here, and so on. It just depends on how symmetric the state is. So, for example, if you take the state up, you know, all up, then they would all be the same, right? And if you take up, down, you know, you would only get two different ones. So it just depends on how symmetric the state is with respect to translation and reflection. So the point is that when we do this sum here, we include all of them, so there will be multiple copies here, in some cases, of the same original basis state, and that will affect the normalization. So again, it's just a matter of some brute algebra to calculate the normalization, and if you do it, what you will find is that you have to, again, you have, as I said, you have to look at the reflections and the translations and see if that can bring you back to the same state. So if that is the case for some m, let's say the lowest m for which this can happen, then this is the normalization, this is always the factor, and then it's multiplied by a cosine here. And if there's no such m, then it's just that factor. So now, also it turns out that in this latter case, if there is such a relationship, or let's say up here, if there is such a relationship, then these sigma plus and minus states are not even orthogonal to each other, so they're basically the same state. And then we should include it only once in the basis. So if we have no such condition, then the basis, the block, will include both the sigma plus one and minus one versions of the state. Otherwise, there will be just one copy of it. And we can choose whichever we like, so it's useful to have some convention. For example, if the sigma plus one state is normalizable, then we include that. Otherwise, we include sigma minus one. Now, when we discussed the momentum states, we discussed the list in which we store all these representatives. So one way to deal now with the fact that we also have this label sigma, and sometimes we both sigma, or typically both sigma plus and sigma one minus one would be present, we could actually store two copies of the same representative, if that is the case. And as before, we will store the periodicity of the state. Now we can also store the sigma value for each state. Okay, so again, I just want to give you really an overview now, so I'm not going to even discuss how to, in detail, how to make the basis anymore, but you have the pseudocode, and I will have these programs available for you, which you will look at and play with a little bit on tomorrow. So if you like, you can go back and really try to understand in detail what they're doing. But basically now, when we check if a state is a valid state in the basis, we again have to do some checks on it. And then we also have to now deal with, so for each of the representatives, we have to look at both sigma plus or minus one. And then we have to decide whether those conditions on the previous slide would apply, if those are really distinct states or not. And in the end, if we have a valid representative, then we add it to the basis, and we store. We can store this sigma label in the same array as the periodicity, because the periodicity is always positive, and sigma is always plus or minus one. So if we just store sigma as the sign of R, we can later extract it if needed. And we need this M, which was when we reflect the state and then translate it, how many times do we have to translate it before it comes back to itself? It again will appear in the Hamiltonian. So it's a little bit messy, but The nice thing with this is that, okay, it is messy, but it's not model dependent. Well, we are doing it for a 1D model, but all these things that I talk about and have on these slides, in principle, when it's worked out once, it's there. So no matter what the Hamiltonian is, all these things will apply because they only pertain to the symmetries of the model, or really in this case, lattice symmetries. Okay, this check state subroutine, so now in addition to checking the magnetization and looking at the translations of the states, now we have to also look at the reflections and translations. I define this function here which reflects the bits, so that's just something you can implement in some way. I don't think there's a built-in functionality for that kind of thing, so you pretty much have to do it manually. Copy the bits in the reverse order into something. And then we get all those numbers. All right. We have to construct the Hamiltonian, and now when we act with, let's say, a spin flip operator, we can get something which is, we will get something which is related to a representative by some number of translations and some number of reflections, and this reflections can be 0 or 1. So that one has to check again when making the Hamiltonian. The expression for the Hamiltonian will be rather messy, but again, it's completely generic once it's worked out once. So one gets... you see, it's a little bit messy. But you get two cases. So since both sigma plus 1 and minus 1 will appear in the basis, there will be matrix elements between that are sort of diagonal in that number. There's one expression for that. And then it depends again if there is such a relation between reflected and translated states. And then there's off-diagonal in sigma, and it looks slightly different. Instead of cosines here, you have sines, it turns out. So, admittedly, it's a little bit messy. So you may even ask, well, is it really worth going to this basis? I mean, the momentum states are reasonably simple, right? I mean, there was a little bit about checking translations and so on. But now when you go to these semi-momentum states with parity, you see, it becomes, 10 times more complicated, at least to actually implement. And the only thing you really gain is that the Hamiltonian matrix will be real instead of complex. So actually, most people that do exact diagonalization for a living, which I don't do, by the way, I just do it for some cases. But most people actually don't do this. It's just too messy, but I decided to do it at some point, and okay, now I have it, so I can use it quite easily if I need to. But if you just start out and do it, you may actually hesitate before you do it. But anyway, I wanted to point it out to you that one can make this real basis. So let's not even discuss how to make the Hamiltonian, other than to say that it's really very similar to before, but now the way I wrote it, which will be in those programs that you can play around with. Since we have these cases, sigma equals plus 1 and minus 1, and those states will appear next to each other, so you will have sometimes two copies of the same representative with different sigmas, when I loop over the basis, I will actually deal with the matrix off-diagonal and diagonal matrix elements of those at the same time. But let's not even discuss it more. So now I want to discuss one more symmetry, which makes it even more complicated. But this is a symmetry that people actually use. But you may also use this symmetry just with the plane momentum states, not necessarily in this semi-momentum basis with parity. Then it would be slightly easier. But here I will combine all these symmetries, and now it will really get quite ugly, as you will see. Or beautiful, depending on how you like complicated formulas. Okay, spin inversion symmetry. If we have a a spin state and then flip all the spins at the same time. The Hamiltonian is invariant under this symmetry, so that if in if we have the block with zero magnetization, any eigenstate in that block will be either even or odd under this spin inversion symmetry. So if you have a block with non-zero magnetization, normally you would not want to use this symmetry because it would mix states with plus magnetization and minus magnetization. So actually it would not be useful at all. But when the magnetization is zero, which often is the case in the ground state, we will discuss that a little bit more later, we can use this symmetry as well. So the spin inversion operator I call Z. So it flips all the spins. So this is the way we construct the eigenstates, and now we combine, we have the semi-momentum states, the sines and cosines here, and then I have the translation and the parity stuff here and the spin inversion stuff. This operator clearly commutes with not only with the Hamiltonian but with the translation and reflection as well, so there's no question that we can use this symmetry in this MZ equals zero block. So one can check explicitly that this state has Z equals plus or minus one. Okay, now even for the normalization, now it gets very messy because it turns out there are five different cases. So if you have to check reflection and translations and see if that gives brings the representative back to itself or not, and then you know translations acting on the reflected state, and then spin inverting, reflecting, and translating, and there are different cases, five different cases it turns out. And then also then you know depending on what you have, the normalization has a different factor there. And in the Hamiltonian, now you have five cases also, but some of them are actually the same. So it looks looks kind of like a mess. So let's not discuss more details about that. So let me show you some examples of these blocks. So what this is showing is the block sizes you get in the sector of zero momentum and zero magnetization. So zero momentum is always the largest momentum block, and that's again because we add with phase one all the states, so there's no state that is, no representative that is forbidden in that momentum block. There will be no cases where everything cancels out because there are no phases. So this is showing now how many states in the blocks for different system sizes, and the sub-blocks here are the parity plus minus one and spin reflection plus minus one. So this is one of the special cases, right, where the normal momentum states, the momentum blocks subdivide into parity plus minus one blocks, and we have the spin inversion symmetry. So now you can see for n equals 8, there is even no state in this block. So you can see really that the blocks are of different size in general, and that's because some of the representatives will be excluded because basically their normalization would be infinite. So that they don't exist, right? The number of states in the blocks increases very quickly, as you can see, and that's what limits us here. So what is this? Around 4.7 million states for n equals 32. So that's a lot. That's too much to do complete diagonalization. And tomorrow we will discuss Lanczos diagonalization, which is a sparse matrix method where you just look for a few low-lying states, and that you can actually do quite easily even for n equals 32. So I should say also that a model like the Heisenberg model is rotationally symmetric in spin space. It's S dot S. So in principle, the states, of course, are labeled by total spin as well. So it's actually much more complicated to construct eigenstates of total spin. So that's why we don't do that, and typically it's not done, because it's the basis states are quite complicated, and the Hamiltonian will be much less sparse if you do that. So what we can do after we have diagonalized our Hamiltonian and we have the states, if we need the spin quantum number, we can compute it. So the spin operator squared, you see, looks almost like a Heisenberg Hamiltonian, except that it's summed over all spin pairs. So it's like the Heisenberg model with equal interactions between all spins. That's the spin squared operator. So you can construct that matrix almost in the same way as you do the Heisenberg model. The only difference is that instead of just ij being nearest neighbors, now you have to sum over all distances between them. Once you have diagonalized the Hamiltonian, have the states, you can compute the spin squared for the state. And you will do that actually, well, you don't have to program it, but you will run some programs and look at the spins in the tutorial tomorrow. Okay, so again, if we do full diagonalization, normally then we would do it in using some symmetries. So here I just use J to refer to a block. It could be a block of magnetization, momentum, and parity, or we could include the spin reflection symmetry. So for each block, you would get a different Hamiltonian, of course, and a different matrix which diagonalizes the Hamiltonian. So I call the diagonalizing matrix D. So this is the matrix you would get when you call a subroutine to diagonalize the Hamiltonian. And E would be a matrix with only diagonal elements then. And then other operators that you construct, such as the spin squared, you transform to that basis, and you can look at matrix elements. Now, if we are interested in finite temperature properties, we have to calculate an expectation value as trace of A times this Boltzmann operator. And now when we have the Hamiltonian in or have the eigenvalues, this just turns into a sum over Boltzmann factors for those states. But now we have to sum over all the symmetry blocks in principle. So what I call here J here. So all MZ values, all K values, all parities, and so on. So they will, if you really want to do finite temperatures, you would have to compute all the blocks. Or as we will see in the next slide, sometimes you don't have to do really all of them. You can exploit some symmetries even there. But anyway, that's what you would do. A question?
Yeah.
You, where is you? Oh, okay, sorry. It's just a typo. It should be D. Sorry. At some point, I guess I called it U, and then I changed the D and forgot to change. Sorry, I will change that. Was there another question? So that was it. All right, good. Okay. Now, but if we want to do this kind of full diagonalization, or we want finite temperature properties, we really need all the states. And well, just looking at here, how big a matrix can we diagonalize? I think in this table, 24 would be really the largest. I think there's no way you can, even on a huge supercomputer, that you can diagonalize a 28 site. I don't think. So, you know, normally maybe 20 or 24 would be the maximum that you would like to do. So let me show you some example of thermodynamics. So it turns out that some quantities you can compute just using the zero magnetization sector. So that's the sector where we can use spin inversion symmetry. So that means that those blocks are typically something like half the size of the general magnetization blocks because they split into two smaller blocks. So now if we have a state with spin S, we know that it should be 2s plus 1 fold degenerate, right, because we don't have any external magnetic field. So if we look at this MZ equals 0 block, of course we only get one of these. So I mean this degeneracy corresponds to MZ, all the values of MZ. But we can exploit the fact that these states are all degenerate, so we actually only have to compute one of them and then include this as a weight factor. Now, of course, it could happen that the expectation values depend on MZ. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. So, for example, if we just compute the energy, the internal energy or the specific heat, all those states would, of course, have exactly the same value of the energy. But if we are looking at something which depends on the magnetization, for example, that could be, we might have to calculate it in all those states. But in some cases, that calculation is trivial. So, for example, if we look at, let's first look at the specific heat. So the specific heat is the temperature derivative of the internal energy, which is the expectation value of H. And we can just compute it. If we just derive an expression for this, this is what it is. It's the fluctuation of the energy. So these things we can, in principle, evaluate. What we also can do, we can just compute the energy on a fine grid of temperature points, and then we can take this derivative numerically. That's normally much easier. If you look at the susceptibility, which is the derivative of the magnetization in the z direction with respect to a field in that direction, it's the fluctuation of the magnetization. And here we can actually exploit this symmetry, even though these values here would depend on MZ, right? That's clear. So, but we are interested in this susceptibility at zero field, so the expectation value of MZ will be zero. In this definition, as you remember before, we also discussed the susceptibility. And then I put an absolute value here to account for the fact that we could have long-range order in the thermodynamic limit, so then I would like to subtract really out that long-range order if we have a situation where this is non-zero in the thermodynamic limit. In the one-dimensional chains we are looking at, that's actually not the case. As I explained before, this Mermin-Wagner theorem excludes order in one dimension in these models, so we should not put any absolute value there, and this is just zero by symmetry. If we look at mz squared, by rotational symmetry, we can write it in this way. It would be the same as mx squared plus my squared plus mz squared divided by 3. And this is nothing but the total spin operator squared. And if we have an eigenstate, expectation value of s squared should be just s times s plus 1. So what we can do is, if we know the spin of these levels in this sector, we can just use this value in place of this mz squared here, and we can get the susceptibility that way. So these are just some examples of what you would do when you study spin chains at finite temperature, and normally what you would like to get is a result for an infinitely long chain, and you can only do up to maybe 20 or 24. Here I even did only up to 16. So you have to check how it converges. So now you see at very high temperatures here, the convergence is very good. So if we do our L equals 16, it's probably good enough down to T equals 1.5 or something like that. What I also show here is just the simple Curie form. So you know, if you have an independent spin, the susceptibility is just one quarter 1 over T for a spin 1 half. So if you have a chain of non-interacting spins, the susceptibility per, this is the specific heat I was starting to, so let's discuss this one, which is what I started to talk about here, the susceptibility. This is actually should also be divided by N if I want the susceptibility per site. So this is the Curie form, I should maybe have extended the scale a little bit here. I wanted to show what's happening down here, but I can guarantee you that if you go to much higher temperature, these curves will in fact coincide with the Curie form. And that's again because at high temperatures, the correlations are so weak, so essentially you have independent spins. At infinite T, you would have exactly independent spins. Right? Yeah. So this is, you mean here or here?
Here.
The left or right?
Left.
Oh, okay, let me get back to that. But even this one diverges. So it's easier to understand this one. So the Curie form is the susceptibility for independent spins. So we know that goes like 100 T. In the spin chain, there are antiferromagnetic interactions. And at some temperature around here, those interactions really become significant and they completely kill this divergence. So if you think of, the antiferromagnetic interaction favors states with small total spin, right? So the susceptibility of a state, or the contribution to the susceptibility from a state with spin zero is zero, right? And in fact, the ground state of these systems has spin zero, and that's why the susceptibility goes to zero as you go to zero temperature. But that's actually a finite size effect, right? So there will be, if you look at the energy spectrum, which you will tomorrow, you will see that the ground state has spin zero, and then there's some gap to the next state, and that has spin one. And this decay here is actually an exponential decay, and it's actually governed by the gap between the singlet and the first triplet. Yes?
So you make two statements. You make some quantities can be computed using only mz equals zero.
Right.
And then you say, no, we have to use mz equals all possible values. Which one do we do?
All right. So it depends on what you want. So in this case here, in these two cases here, in practice, you only have to look at this second. And that's because this average you can calculate analytically just from the fact that the system is rotational invariant. So what I'm doing here is the same as taking the average over all magnetization sectors, right? Because what I write here is an average, and just by spin rotational symmetry, I can replace that average by one over all components, and that's equal to S squared, where this is the total spin operator. So these magnetizations is just the sum of the spin components squared, and if you write the total, well, we already did it. Right here, it's just that expression, the XX and YY and ZZ components, and then instead of a double sum, you can write it as one sum squared.
So we just get the expectation value of SS plus one, and it's the same.
Right. Okay. Exactly. Right, and there should be one over N there for what I computed. So these are finite size effects, and eventually you would like to go to zero temperature, but just based on this data, you cannot really do it. Although the people that first did this in the 60s, they tried, and I'm going to discuss that more when we talk about quantum Monte Carlo, where we can actually go to much bigger systems. So that will be next week. I will comment more on that. Right now, let's get back to the specific heat. One can just compute the leading high temperature form of the specific heat. It's very easy to do. I don't want to go through that now here, but it also diverges. But that's just an artifact of again, this is a high temperature form. So actually, if you compute the specific heat for two spins, which you can easily do by hand, you actually get this form. So in the case of the susceptibility, the leading form corresponds to a single spin, but for the specific heat, you can imagine that for just a single spin, you get nothing because the specific heat is the fluctuation in the energy, and for a single spin, there is no Heisenberg energy at all. But if you have two spins, you can compute it, and the leading high temperature form of that just for two spins turns out to be exactly the same as if you formally do a high temperature expansion for the infinite lattice. Yep.
So if you look at the dependence of specific heat, then the divergence occurs for particular value of L.
No, so this is the form one over T squared. This one. But again, it's just the leading term in the high temperature expansion. So it's just to show that okay, here we are still quite close to that form, but again, eventually the interaction, so you can think of it again as a non-interacting result, a non-interacting dimer of two spins giving you that form. But in reality, of course, when the temperature becomes small, the spins will strongly correlate with each other. And that form is irrelevant. And any time again when you have a gap in the spectrum, which you have for a finite size, the specific heat has to go to zero because it's the fluctuation of the energy. So if you just have one level, the fluctuation is zero, and at very low temperature, you only get contribution from one level. So again, there's always a decay to zero due to finite size. Now, in the case of the specific heat, actually also in the infinite system, the specific heat does go to zero. I think it goes like one, it goes like T squared, probably. But the susceptibility, as we will see when we do quantum Monte Carlo, will actually go to a finite value. The value is even known exactly. This chain has, the Heisenberg chain has an exact solution, the beta ansatz solution, and I think actually if you just this looks almost linear here, and if you just draw a line here, it will actually pretty closely hit the exact value. But it turns out that the behavior is actually more complicated than that, so we will look more at that. All right, so that was just an example of thermodynamics. These are special cases where you just get everything you need from that block. So if you are interested in the thermodynamics of some more complicated observable, then you may have to use all the blocks. All right. Okay, so now I want to talk about the Lanczos method. So as we saw, we cannot do these full diagonalizations when the system size is larger than 20 or something like that. If we only restrict to the ground state and let's say a small number, whatever that means, small number of excitations, we can use what's called the Krylov space methods, and those are methods that really don't diagonalize the full Hamiltonian. They only give us a small number of states. And we can easily handle 10 million or more states, so something like 30 to 40 spins. So let's first talk in general about the so-called Krylov space, and then the Lanczos method is one special case of such a method. So let's take an arbitrary state, and now we could consider a state in the full Hilbert space, or we could consider a state in one of these symmetry blocks. It could be a state with fixed momentum and magnetization and so on. Now let's act with a high power of the Hamiltonian on that state. So that state has some expansion in eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. So n is an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, and Cn is the expansion coefficient. High power, this is lambda is large, so this is the power of the Hamiltonian, this is the lambda power of the Hamiltonian, right? H times H times H. So now, since these are eigenstates, of course, now we get the eigenvalue to the lambda, and now let's pull out the eigenvalue E0 in front of everything. Then we just get the ground state with some factor, and the next state with some factor which contains a ratio of energies, and so on. Okay, now, if the ground state, so the ground state has the lowest energy, right? Often, but not always, it's also the state with largest magnitude of the energy. Right? So we have some finite spectrum for finite size energies. We have some levels. So this is E naught. And at some point we have, let's say this is zero. And let's say this is Em, which is the highest energy. So often, so now the way I drew it here, you see that E naught also has the largest magnitude. The distance to here is larger than the distance to here. So if that's the case, then you see that the ground state here will completely dominate, because all these factors will then be smaller than one, right? So if lambda is large, these three factors for all of what follows here will go to zero. So that means in the limit of large lambda, this projects out the ground state. That's the terminology used for this. So we are just left with the ground state times some number. Now, if this is not the case, if the ground state E naught is not the largest in magnitude, then what we would get is the highest state. We would get Em here dominating instead. So we should pull out here the largest in magnitude, and then we get that, whatever that state is. We are always interested in the ground state, not the highest state. So we can always cure that potential problem by just shifting the zero of the energy by adding a constant. So instead of looking at eigenvalues of h, we can look at eigenvalues of h minus c. And if c is big enough, then E naught will be the largest in magnitude. Right? So in principle, this is a way to get the ground state. Just acting many, many times on an arbitrary state, so for example a randomly generated state, and eventually you get the state. You don't know what this prefactor is, because if you just take a random state, you don't know to start with what is this expansion coefficient, and you also don't initially know the energy. You can later compute it if you like. But we don't know this expansion coefficient, but that doesn't matter, because when we get the state, we can just normalize it later on, and then we can compute anything we like. Okay, so that's one way. And in fact, when we talk about quantum Monte Carlo, if I have time at the end of next week, I will talk about the projector method for Heisenberg-type models, which also builds on this. Some of you actually know this method already very well. But now let's do this in the context of exact diagonalization. Well, it turns out that this is, one can do this, but it's even better to consider a linear combination of many of these states. So here I just use the fixed power lambda. Here I write a state as a linear combination of many powers of that Hamiltonian. So let me see now, what am I actually doing? I'm just forgetting what my notation A means here. Now, why did I add an A there? So, okay, yeah, because we have many states, right? So for if we have all the powers from 0 to lambda, in principle, we can construct lambda plus 1 orthogonal states based on those, right? So if we do that and then diagonalize the Hamiltonian in that space of states, we actually typically, or actually always, get a lower energy than if we just use a finite power here. Meaning, see, that this is never giving you exactly the ground state. Right? There's always some stuff left here. So if we do this and then compute the expectation value of the energy, we can say that's our energy. It would always pay to not just take that final state, but to construct a linear combination of all the states we get in the process of acting with the Hamiltonian. And that's almost for free, because if we act with the high power of the Hamiltonian, what we do is, first we act once, then we act again and again and again. So in that process, we do get all these states. We have the original state, then H times the state, another power of H acting on the state, and so on. And okay, what these expansion coefficients are, we don't need to care, actually. I just wrote it formally in this way here to say that, well, we form some linear combination and use those as basis states and then diagonalize in that space. Was there a question there? All right. Okay, so this will become clearer what we actually do when we do it in practice. So there are many choices for this. Yes, please.
So the aim is to know the different set of prefactors to your...
Right. So in principle, if you just consider all these states, so you have some psi which you start from, mm-hmm. and then you have H times psi. Mm-hmm. So we can call that, let's just call it like this.
Yeah.
And then we have H squared times psi, which is just H times phi 1, and this would be H times phi 0. And so on. We have all these states, but they are not orthogonal to each other in general, okay. Right? They would just, but we could orthogonalize them, and if we do that, that's an orthogonal set of states, which if this lambda is large enough, we could make that to span the whole Hilbert space, right? If lambda is equal to the size of the Hilbert space, then that would be a complete basis. But typically the Hilbert space is very large, let's say 10 million states. And we could use, let's say, lambda equals 100. Then we get 100 orthogonal states. And it turns out that those states normally cover the space where the ground state is. So if this represents my Hilbert space, and let's see, so now the ground state of some Hamiltonian is there. So if we just use our original state, that's another point here, and then we act with the Hamiltonian, and now we have two states, so that spans some region of that space. So this is just some abstract representation of the space. and if we add one more space, we span a little bit more, and we get, of course, closer and closer to where we could actually represent that space, that state. And it turns out that because we use the Hamiltonian itself to construct those states, that we quite quickly, in that hugely dimensional space, we quite quickly get close to where the ground state is. And it would be, well, if we just take the states themselves, so if that's the original state there, and then H acting on that state is some other state there, and H squared times the states and so on, eventually we will also get to that state. But if we keep all these other states, we have somehow more directions in the space, and we can form some linear combination which is better than just those individual states. That's the point. So anytime that you add something, some other direction to your space, you can of course reproduce a larger class of states. So that's the point. So now this Lanczos basis is one particular example of how to construct that basis. So there are many ways to do it. This is not unique. And it turns out to be very convenient. So let's look at that. Maybe I still have time to do that today. So let's construct the Lanczos basis. So first we will do this in two steps. So first I will construct a basis which is an orthogonal basis but not normalized. So like these states that I drew on the board there, they are not normalized, right? I just wrote them as H acting on something, so we would have to normalize them as well. So these states will not initially not be normalized, and later I will normalize them. Okay, let me introduce some notation. So I will call N basically what we need to normalize the states, just the overlap of these states with themselves. So this M here will go from 0 to what I called lambda before. Okay, HMM will just be the matrix element of the Hamiltonian in those states, so the expectation value in those states. Okay, the first state, F0, is arbitrary. Normally, it's just a randomly generated state. And again, we imagine that we are working in some symmetry block of the Hamiltonian, so we could think of a momentum state or even using more symmetries. Okay, so then we construct the second state, which is F1. So we act with the Hamiltonian on F0, and then we subtract some component of the previous state F0. And why we do that is exactly because we want these states F0 and F1 to be orthogonal to each other. So if we just compute the overlap, we see that if this A0 is H0 divided by N0, then F1 and F0 are orthogonal to each other. Okay, so now we have two states in an orthogonal basis. Then we go on. The next state looks like that, acting with the Hamiltonian and then subtracting some amount of those previous two states. Again, we can demand that F2 is orthogonal to both the previous ones, and that gives us those prefactors. So we get these numbers A1 and B0. So now we have three states. Okay, now you might imagine, just seeing what I did here, acting with the Hamiltonian, subtracting the previous one. Acting with the Hamiltonian, subtracting two previous ones. Well, probably now acting with the Hamiltonian and subtracting some component of the three previous ones and so on. But the magic of this is that this is the general formula now. We always only need to act on the previous one and subtract some amount of the previous two. then it turns out that the whole set is automatically orthogonal. And I will not prove that, but it's actually very easy to do. So in this case, what we had for the second state, those expressions completely generalize. And if you just now prove that Fm plus, if you just compute Fm plus 1 overlapping with Fm in this case, you will see that the overlap is a zero. And then the proof is by recursion, because we can do them. What we know that these explicitly, that the F0, 1, 2 are orthogonal. Then we can prove that F3 is orthogonal to F2. Let's see now. Well, actually, maybe it's not just recursion, but you can actually explicitly check that they are all, and it's very easy that they all are orthogonal. So let's look at the Hamiltonian. That's the last thing I want to do today. So we had the let me jump back here. So we had this generic formula for how to construct the next state. From that, we can write what is H times Fm in terms of Fm plus 1. So just rewrite that equation. Did you have some question, by the way? Yeah, but it does. So yeah, you should just sit down and you will see that it.
Mm-hmm. Is it a form of expression of Schmidt's method of
Yeah, so you don't need to, I mean that would be, you mean the way to orthogonalize states in general? Well, so you don't need to even do that here, because this actually turns out to be automatic. These states are automatically orthogonal. Actually, I will mention something like that tomorrow, because this is mathematically speaking, right? But when we do all these things in the computer, there will be some accumulation of round-off errors and so on, and eventually the orthogonality will break down, and that causes some problems. So then we may have to do something like that to re-orthogonalize the states. But for now, this is not Gram-Schmidt orthogonalization, it's just something that follows automatically. And it seems almost like magic why it would, right? But
does it have to depend on the Hamiltonian at all, or is it general?
No, I guess the only thing is that this should be a symmetric or Hermitian matrix. It doesn't even have to be a Hamiltonian.
So Gram-Schmidt would require a whole bunch of terms depending on what vector you run. How do we only get away with two here?
Well, okay, so in these first cases, we showed it explicitly and well, without actually starting to do the proof. If you just do M3 and you use this formula and you go back and check, you will see that they actually are orthogonal. That's all I can say without actually doing the proof. Yeah, it may seem surprising that it should come out automatically, but it actually does. Just try it. You know, you can do it. You know, quite quickly. It's not even difficult. I just didn't want to do the details here. But maybe I should, in view of this seeming maybe like black magic, not just magic. Okay, let's look at the Hamiltonian. So this is just rewriting that expression. So now we can get H times Fm in terms of Fm plus 1. And now again, we can construct the matrix element. So now we just have to take the overlap of this with all these states. And now because of the orthogonality, the only ones that will survive is if we have F minus 1, M or M plus 1 there. And these will be the matrix elements in terms of those A and B coefficients. But now these F states are not normalized, so we should, of course, normalize them, and this is what's the normalization. These Ns are the overlaps. So if we do that, we can rewrite, those matrix elements will only contain those A and B factors. Okay, I think it's time to end today, so next time we will discuss this more, and hopefully you have checked the orthogonality there by then, so you can believe that it's actually true. I'm not lying to you here. Okay, so see you tomorrow.